In the days following the 2016 election, I was drawn to a book published just as the fall campaign was getting underway. It helped me understand the election and the forces roiling in the country. The book was Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right by sociologist Arlie Hochschild. Almost a decade ago, she ventured into the Republican heartland, the state of Louisiana, and stayed there on and off for about 5 years. During that time, she grappled with what she called the deep story of voters who were determined to elect Donald Trump as their next president. 4 years later, in a day before Election Day, I wanted to check in with her again. In what has become the most factious era of U.S. politics, I feel like I need help understanding. So I called Arlie and asked if she could join us this morning, and she was very nice and said yes. My hope was that she would help us dissect what is happening within our nation, more accurately, what has happened, what is happening, and what will happen beginning with tomorrow. Arlie Hochschild is Professor Emerita in the Department of Sociology at the University of California at Berkeley, and it's a great pleasure to welcome her back to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. What a great pleasure to have you.
Well, it's a great pleasure to be here, Joe. Yeah.
So give us a sense of where you think we are in regards to, you write this book, and you were originally looking at the Tea Party and the rise of the Tea Party in 2011.
Right.
Do you think that we have migrated from that in an incredible way? Or have those positions that you wrote about in your book have just hardened over the last 4 years?
I'd say they've deepened. I've been back to Lake Charles, Louisiana, where I sort of based myself to get to know people there, many of them associated with the petrochemical industry, and deeply committed to the Tea Party. Some people have actually come to visit me here that I wrote about the book. And since then, I think we've seen their commitment to the Tea Party has kind of been transferred to a commitment to Donald Trump. It's as if the Tea Party was a stepping stone and almost dissolved into a movement that was larger than it. You could say it got eaten up, not by the Republican Party, but by the Trump side of the Republican Party. Many of them, when I first interviewed them, were saying, well, the real problem was the debt. You know, we're paying too much money for, we're giving away to the other nations, to poor people here. We have to get the debt down. When I went back after the book, I didn't hear a word about debt. You know, that was, you know, it gone from first to 10th on the list of things. So how did that happen? I think it's because they felt a larger movement that encompassed more of their values was to be found in following Donald Trump.
So more of their values, in the sense that it was more valuable to them, if you will, than being with a Tea Party, that it offered them more Trumpism, if you will, offered them more than the Tea Party did.
Right. And my question was, what is it that they find in him? And I think it's not a question of this or that policy. It's almost a question of who I am and my way of life, and is it of value? And they have felt, this group of Tea Party people who are now ardent supporters of Donald Trump, have felt that their standing in the world was going down, right? Mm. These are not abjectly poor people. This is, in a way, the elite of the left behind. And I actually think, so we have well-paid pipe fitters, for example, who aren't earning any more now than they did 20 years ago, you know. And they feel that the coastal elites are looking down on them as racist and sexist and homophobic and fat. They feel, and like rednecks. And they're very insulted by that and feel that someone has come in to lift them up. I actually think that sector of society is what's behind a lot of right-wing movements around the world, you know, in Hungary, Austria, Germany, France, India, that's the sector that has found itself, in a way, they feel saved. It's almost religious, saved by Trump. And then he comes to them, and this is, again, people wonder how evangelicals can actually think of such a secular figure, thrice married, you know, affairs and the like, how they can think he's Christian. But I think what he does is come in as a savior figure. They think he fits a deep paradigm here. And then he says, oh, I am surrounded by enemies, right? The deep state, the Democratic Party, you know, the treasonous mainstream press, you know, I'm surrounded by enemies. He even started to think, you know, the military was against him. And so I appeal to you. I need your help because I'm defending you. You need to defend me against these enemies. And then a promise of rescue, right? And then he kind of says, I'm suffering, right? I'm suffering for you. It's as if he's imagining himself as Jesus almost. And some people see him as that. So I think this is a frequency on which a lot of secular liberals do not tune in, you know, and it just seems strange. But I think it's a big part of his enormous appeal.
When you talk, I was struck by you're talking about the elite of the group of those who were Tea Party members and now are within the Trump camp. You were talking about the money that they made as pipe fitters and so forth, but that hasn't gone up, has it? I mean, that the money they've made has not increased. The economics has not increased.
Exactly, and that's part of the thing. They feel themselves slipping. And I think the big divide is actually between people with BAs and people without BAs. And those without BAs think, oh my goodness, all the new jobs and the better paid jobs won't be available to me, right? I am slipping down. And automation is going to take over my job as a truck driver, right, or as a steam fitter. And they're right. And in other societies, there are ready retraining programs, and someone makes sure that you get relocated and your skill set finds a job. In Germany, for example, you know, the blue-collar workers are more valued and better taken care of. So anyway, I think a lot of them are frightened, and it's not a. There are two different ways of being afraid. One is that you'll never get, and the other is you'll lose what you have, right? You'll never get, or you'll lose what you have. And the Tea Party's, I think, the core feeling and dread is I'll lose what little I have, which is so hard won. I've worked so hard. I'm going to lose it. That's the feeling, and it goes very deep.
That is also the issue, of course, that many African American and voters of color feel as well. And yet they are looking at a more democratic way of saying there is more that we can fight for if we continue in this direction.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, I've given talks on strangers in universities, and there, too, I think a lot of students, African-American students, first-generation students, feel the same thing, feel, look, I worked so hard to get here, right? Don't take this away from me. They dread Donald Trump, I think, rightly, that he's going to try and steamroller over them, that he... So there's that same thing of I have a fragile grasp on something I feel I've earned, and a lot of them felt, well, don't build bridges to those people who are threatening me. You know, I don't want to, oh, they're just a bunch of racists. Don't be making any kind of bridge building to them. They are the enemy. Which I think is a misstep. I think it's a very important misstep. I think we need all kinds of bridges. In fact, in the direction we're going, the divisions that I saw in 2011, as I go back there, have grown deeper. It's not you're in one party and I'm in another, or I believe this about climate change and you believe that. It's like people are living in different realities.
Right.
And the most important reality that there's a big divide about now is whether this is an honest or rigged election. So that there are people that feel, look, if Donald Trump loses, it's because it's been stolen. I mean, there are a lot of people that believe that now. It's what he's saying,
right.
And they're believing it well. The rest of the population thinks, no, this is, I cast my vote, and I want it to count, and have faith that through all of American history, we have trusted elections. So that's a huge kind of primal source of division that I didn't see in 2011. It's grown worse. We do need those bridges.
Arlie Hochschild is our guest this morning, Professor Emerita in the Department of Sociology at the University of California at Berkeley. In the book, Strangers in Their Own Land, you write about the empathy wall and our need, the necessity to climb and to, as you say, bridges, to go over that empathy wall and to understand one another. But whether you're voting for Joe Biden or you're voting for Donald Trump or another option, not voting at all, you have very strong feelings. And as you say, that's only hardened. And it's only hardened on the left as well. So that seems particularly dangerous as we move forward of whatever happens tomorrow.
Right.
As right. We try to, build those bridges. But is anybody going to be coming with the lumber?
Yeah, right. You know, this is a problem on both sides. And I think the very idea of an empathy wall has to be explained. There are some people I've talked to saying, no, we don't want any empathy wall. And they're confusing understanding another person with giving up who you are. And that's a very important misconception to clear up, that to empathize with another person doesn't mean you alter any of your basic positions or convictions. It just means you're capable now of something extra beyond. And a lot of other people feel actually it's a good day spent actually doing political work simply by staying within your bubble and blaming fictive enemies, people you've never met. Like, that's really an accomplishment. I think that's another misconception, because it's denying the fact that actually your politics is increasingly hinged to your zip code. If you happen to live, you know, in a city on a coast, in New England, in California, you're likely to be on the progressive side. If you happen to be grow up on a farm in Iowa or in eastern Kentucky or south, you're likely to be surrounded by people in another bubble and to yourself fall into that, the reality that comes with the bubble. You know, we used to have institutional ways of connecting people across regions and classes and races. And I think the compulsory draft, for one thing, put people who were very different from each other in class, race, region. And we don't have that. I think the labor union movement used to mix and match people across bubbles. But without those and without some substitute for them, we need to get up new structural bridges, and we need to develop mediation skills individually. You know, if you take Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez, reaching across the aisle to Ted Cruz, which she recently did. They both agreed. They had common ground. Two more opposite people, I can't imagine. That common ground in being against corruption, that Congress people could serve for 2 years in, as representatives of the people, and then roll into lucrative lobbying jobs. They wanted to stop that, but they found and they sought common ground. I so admire that. That's what we need, and we need to look at the big bridge builders, at Nelson Mandela, who became president in South Africa when everyone was gritting their teeth and fearing a racial bloodbath, which did not happen because of his skills. So I think those should be our new heroes, people that can do that. And by the way, there are bridge builders on the other side. I got a letter from a wonderful minister who wrote me after Strangers came out, and he said, I am an evangelical minister in Kilgore, Texas, and you have described my people, the people I serve in my church. You've described me. So here's Tea Party. And but you've done it respectfully and carefully, and I thank you for that. And then he said, but I'm not happy with President Trump. So he was in that situation. And then he wrote me at the end of the letter, and he said, so imagine in this turmoil and sense of difficulty the nation is having of finding that some good news came from, of all places on earth, Berkeley, California. I love that. So I wrote him back, thank you so much for your, you know, generous words. And then I ended it, from your friend in Berkeley, California. Mm-hmm. Actually, I'm not from Berkeley, but anyway, you knew what it meant to him. And
absolutely.
And we've stayed in touch now.
Arlie Hochschild is Professor Emerita in the Department of Sociology at the University of California. Her 2016 book was Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right. We're going to continue our discussion with Arlie Hochschild and talk much more about the election tomorrow and the ramifications right after this short break. Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Joe Donahue. Arlie Hochschild is our guest, Professor Emerita in the Department of Sociology at the University of California at Berkeley. She's the author of the 2016 book, Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right. The book is published in paperback by the New Press. So you went out and you looked at what was happening in Louisiana, and now, all these years later, we're getting ready to vote again. Millions of us have already voted, and we'll see what happens. Do you sense, as so many are concerned about / predicting, that there will be great unrest by the end of this week because of what happens on either side? Do you get a sense of that? Do you get a sense? I mean, we were talking in our first segment about bridges, but we're also talking and great concern, and I would argue legitimate concerns over violence, over civil disobedience, over real tragedy that could come as a result that we all pray to God does not happen. But is it important that we think of it as a possibility?
Oh, I think, Joe, you're absolutely right to brace against violence. And I don't say that in some flippant way, but if you look at what the preconditions of violence are, they're there. There is a deep distrust. Actually, Trump himself has sown a distrust of mail-in ballots, for example. So any piece of information, you know, was a mail-in ballot found in a junk pile, something like that, a piece, I just made that up, but if that were said, oh, then who did that? You know, there is just a snarl of distrust about something as basic as our election, basic to democracy. So our very institutions are undergoing a stress test. And the stress is on our faith in them, you know. And so, you know, I'm a little, and that's one thing to look at. And the other are things like Donald Trump's statement to the Proud Boys, you know, stand by, stand back. It's as if he's trying to lead an army to move in, and enforce his will. That's my own perspective. And that's frightening. That's frightening. So I think you're right to be concerned about this. And I think we need to, everybody needs to vote. I think find a good way to vote. And people should volunteer to be poll takers. We need to restore a faith in the process that we're about to move into. And I'm reminded a little about World War I, that, you know, the Germans didn't think they lost because their troops were in occupying other countries. What had happened is they were out of food, and people within the country were starving. That's why they signed that truce. But a lot of prisoners came home from occupying other countries saying, well, wait a minute, we won. And that was part of the resentment, the humiliation of the treaty. You know, they were so humiliated that it was that emotional steam that got behind World War II. So we have to go very carefully here. We have to look at history and make sure there is a shared understanding of what's going on. And that's where the bridge building comes in.
I do not mean in any way, shape, or form to oversimplify this, but the title of the book was Strangers in Their Own Land, and that was meant to be about members of the Tea Party.
Right.
So here we are, and I think many Democrats and many on the left look and say, you drive down the road. Yes, I live in a blue state of New York, but you drive down the road and there are three signs for Joe Biden and there are 20 signs for Donald Trump, and they are huge and they have flags and they have it's adorned on the side of the houses. I have to say I often do, as I'm driving to and from work, when I get out of the house, feel like a stranger.
Right. I think you're absolutely right that many on the left are feeling like we are the strangers in our own land. That's actually in the book at the very end. I write a letter to each side, and the letter I write to the right is, hey, you should know that a lot of people on the left feel like strangers in their land, and that was even before all this had happened. There's a mutual alienation. And rural urban, the one you're just describing, is, that's white on white. There's race is basic here, but so is social class and occupation in a way, So there's a lot we need to do. The two fronts, one is a long-term front. We need to look at how globalization has created winners and losers, and how actually the government under both parties has failed to deal with and support the structural losers of globalization. That's a long-term thing that would address much of the source of fear and anguish underneath politics. But then in the short run, we do need to create some bridges, not so that we'll agree on things, but so that we'll disagree in a civil way.
I was struck by some of the statistics that were given over the vote for Justice Amy Coney Barrett, that when you heard the Republican members of the Judiciary Committee during the hearings, they were talking about how they were voting for Republican. They had voted in the past for quote unquote liberal judges. And so now we have a justice who didn't receive a single vote by a Democrat. And I just, without getting into a discussion about the court, it just seems to me that there was a time in our politics, of course, where a president would advance a justice. And I certainly understand that this one was more fractious than other times. But it does show that there was some understanding that, yes, we have a job to fill and this is what we have to do, as opposed to this putting our foot down and it's my way or the highway.
Right, right.
And I don't know how we get over that without somebody having to cry uncle. And I don't I don't know who that would be.
I know what you're saying. And we, I mean, one thing that feels so essential and feels more precarious than it has in the past is kind of the neutrality and the of the apolitical nature, but the neutrality of a lot of branches of government. And we have a civil service. We don't think of that as a Republican or Democratic civil service, right? We have a military, you know, and its leaders proudly say we're defending the nation, not a party, not a politician, right? This is democracy in action. And so to have something so thoroughly politicized is frightening and is not a good sign.
And you look at what, I mean, there are federal employee unions that are suing the Trump administration over executive orders on civil service. There is a politicization that has happened throughout, and again, this has been going on far. This is not just the Trump administration, although it certainly has increased over the last 4 years. One of the things that I know you and I talked about the last time you were on, I believe in 2018, around the midterms, was if. With what you know about the Tea Party and at that time in 2011, if it wasn't Donald Trump, would it have been someone else? In the sense that, let's face it, they're perhaps very ideologically similar, Mike Pence and Donald Trump, but the tenor would have been different. The vulgarity would have been different. The method would have been different. I don't know if that ultimately makes a difference, but it seems as though that there, if anything else, the volume wouldn't have been turned up quite as high.
Yeah, yeah. I think there's a lot of wisdom in what you say, that the Tea Party arose because and it caught on when the banks were being bailed out after the 2008 depression, but the people weren't, and it was, you know, what's the government spending its money on? You know, if there was a member, Republican member of Congress, I think, who was saying, well, wait a minute, are we supposed to legitimate the guaranteed rebuilding of you know, extra room on a house of an affluent person? I mean, what is our tax dollar going to? Because we are losing, and, you know, so we're going to make sure our government isn't taking our and misusing our tax dollars. That was, I think there were several moments that led to the rise of the Tea Party, but that was a very basic one. And so there was a lot of dissatisfaction, and you're right, it would have taken different forms, but this has taken a quite frightening form in that distrust has been sown, and agencies that are, you know, hardworking people doing good work, suddenly now suspect. And trust is turns out to be very precious in the construction of our society, our civil society, and our government. And that the volume is higher and the distrust is deeper on both sides. I've talked to people who said, look what's happening at the EPA, Environmental Protection Agency. They're holding on to, first they cut by a third of the staff and the money, and then the committees are being filled with lobbyists, and the scientists are being taken out, and people with special interest put in, with the title of the committee remaining what it was. So people think, oh my God, what used to be something for the benefit of the people is now no longer for the benefit of the people, and it's so there's a lot of distrust on both sides. Yeah.
And so, it seems now as good a time as any to bring up the fact that, you know, we could talk about this, and we can talk about politics, and we can talk about it as if it's a matter of life and death. Well, guess what? We have a pandemic, and there are a great number of people who either don't believe it or don't believe that it is as bad as it sounds, and they also believe that if there is a mask mandate or there is any sort of shutdown, that they will A, not comply with it, and B, that it is a way of a political move as opposed to a way of saving the lives of people. Well, I don't know when it comes to that. I don't know how do you argue it? We've seen it play out. We've seen it in front of us. And you have someone on a very big stage with a very big megaphone saying it's going to go away. And then you have scientists who say, well, no, it's not. And not only that, but we're going to see a lot more people dead by the end of the year. I don't know if I apologize for this very, very bad metaphor, but I mean, you're talking about bridges, but, you know, it seems like they're going to be made out of stretchers here if we don't work a little bit quicker on getting this worked out. My point being, of all we've been talking about, this is an issue, it seems, where time is of the essence to get moving and figure out what we're going to do.
Right, right. It's as if we now have a political solvent that's ungluing things that have been glued together for a very long time. And we need to address the whole question of trust and distrust. And there is a feeling on the right among the people I came to know and the ones I'm interviewing now in a different region of, well, the left has been trying to take Donald Trump down, right? And he has critics and enemies, and so COVID is yet another instrument through which he's being criticized, and people are trying to unseat him. So that's, I mean, to many of us, bizarre, because, you know, a germ is a germ, and a pandemic is a pandemic. But there are people in Lake Charles who say, is COVID real? Yeah.
Right.
But I'll tell you who is the model to me of how to handle it. And it's in Kentucky. It's Governor Beshear. He's in the middle, as COVID is coming to middle America and to red states. He, at 5 o'clock the end of every day, he's saying, okay, here's how we're doing. And he just speaks so reasonably. He said, look, none of us quite knew how to handle this, right? This, we're all new, so, but we're in this together. And he then says, wearing a mask is a way in which we Kentuckians show we care for our families and our neighbors and our fellow churchgoers. You know, it's we care. We have loving communities, and we're thoughtful people. And so wearing a mask is not a matter of following an order of a faceless bureaucrat. It's a matter of caring about your neighbor. And it's protecting your neighbor. And so instead of lending the wearing of a mask to a kind of, macho, don't tell me what to do kind of ethic, he lent a meaning to masks that people think is good, right?
Right.
I'm protecting others. It's not you're being a wimp, you're being just the opposite. In other words, to not wear a mask means that you're not protecting. If you want to know a male function of protecting, it's wearing a mask. You know, what he's doing is reminding people of the social relations involved and giving them dignity to wear a mask. It's that there's been a challenge to the dignity of wearing a mask. So that's how deep this new divide is, you know, the very meaning of wearing a mask. But what the governor has done is to daily reinforce the dignity and the identity, you know, of being a proud Kentuckian.
Mm.
Wear your mask. Yeah. So it's at that level that I think the rebuilding of trust and understanding has to go on.
As we wrap up our conversation, and we're out of time, but I do want to leave it with this question, which is a big one and I'm sure hard to answer, but looking at the totality of everything that we have discussed over this hour, do you think, in your opinion, as a sociologist and as a human, do you think we're going to be okay?
I do. But I think part of what's to learn from the trouble that I think is shortly going to come upon us is that we have a lot of short-term and long-term work to do. And it's addressing these long-term needs of people who have fallen on hard times. It's long-term rebuilding institutions that put diverse populations in contact with one another at every level. That we need it in Congress. We need it in state-to-state relationships at leadership level, state level, community level, neighborly level, to get a lot of bridges going and addressing common problems. So part of this is a big heads up and part of it, we just have to brace ourselves. I think we're in for some difficulty, but yeah, I think we'll come out wiser on the other side.
Nothing wrong with that, coming out a little bit wiser. Arlie Hochschild is Professor Emerita in the Department of Sociology at the University of California at Berkeley. Her book, published in 2016, is Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right. It is out in paperback, published by the New Press. Arlie, I can't thank you enough for taking the time out. I so enjoy speaking to you and really admire your wisdom, and I thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Well, it's wonderful to talk with you too, Joe. So, best of luck.
Be well. Thank you very much. Again, Arlie Hochschild is a professor emerita in the Department of Sociology at the University of California, Berkeley. The name of the book, Strangers in Their Own Land. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.